Hello, and welcome to episode 4 of The Winning Agenda. Tonight, our panellists include local judge, tournament organiser and contributor to the Australian Tabletop Gaming Network, Thomas Daniel.
Hey guys.
Runner-up for both the 2014 Melbourne Regionals and the 2014 Australian Nationals, Liam Prasad.
Hey there.
Two-time store champion and two-time Magic the Gathering Pro Tour competitor, Wilfie Hurrig.
Hey, what's up?
2014 Adelaide Regional champion and 2014 Australian National champion, Jesse Marshall.
Good evening.
And I'm Brian Holland, 2014 Australian Nationals top 8 competitor. Last week, as most of you will remember, we ran a competition for the best topic or question that would come through to us. We're happy to announce that the winner is Mark P. So the question he sent in, which we're now going to answer, is, I'm only new to Netrunner, so I'd love a discussion based on ice. What strategies are there? What types of ice should I include? And most importantly, where do I place certain types of ice? This is a strategy topic that I think most of us are really interested in talking about. Wilfie, could you start us off there? What do you think is the most important thing to take care of when you're talking about ice and how to include ice in your decks?
Yeah, so this is a deceptively deep topic because it really, while we all know that ice is the foundation of our decks and we need to consider ice when building our decks, there are lots of ways we can go, and it's not always clear what sort of configuration is good specifically when building your decks. Of course, playing with ice is deep as well, but at the moment I'll just talk a little bit on what ice to maybe include in your deck. So the most important thing to consider is having a good mix of types, and two, having each ice be efficient. The reason that having a good mix of types is useful, say, not necessarily an even split, but some split such that ideally on turn one or turn two, when you play two ice, you want them to be different types, and throughout the game, you want your opponent to be required to get all three of their breakers. Because ice breakers are so polarizing, either they're really good and you need to draw them to progress in the game as the runner, or they're really bad and they're just useless to have in your hand, it's really important as the corp to maximize the number of situations where your opponent can't get through your ice. And as an aside, that's why AI ice breakers are so good. So it's important that you consider having a split of ice types in your deck. Obviously, not all factions can do this as efficiently. Like, for example, Wayland has a lack at the moment of good code gates, and NBN has a lack of good sentries. But, you know, if you can try and at least get some mix, that would be reasonable. And the second element would be the efficiency of the ice. It's not always important to have ice which is the most efficient. Of course, there needs to be some consideration to the split, but if you force your opponent to pay more credits to get through your ice as the game goes on, then you'll gain an advantage. So something which you could be looking for there is how expensive the ice is to break using the common icebreakers. Like, a sentry with equivalent stats to a barrier will be generally more efficient because sentry breakers are generally less efficient than barrier breakers. So that needs to be considered, both the type and the stats, the res cost, strength, and number of subroutines, or number of useful subroutines. Some subroutines, like the most common subroutine that isn't as useful, sometimes is subroutines that make your opponents lose clicks, so they maybe need to be considered as half a subroutine or so when considering, say, efficiency level of your ice. And that's another reason why Eli is so good, and in fact Eli will only get better as the game goes on, while having a drawback which allows your opponent to click to use their credits to click through the ice. This drawback means that they're not using their clicks to do useful things, and presumably your opponent has built their deck such that they can do useful things with their clicks. So forcing your opponent to use a Corroder, which is the most common barrier breaker, and spend 4 each time they want to get through your Eli, or face the almost as punishing cost of having to pay 2 clicks plus the 1 click to run, means Eli is really good.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in there and maybe outline some of the different roles that ice can play in your deck. Aside from having different types, there are different things that you want your ice to be doing. So one common type is destroyers, to destroy your opponent's programs. Destroying the runner's programs can be a really massive tempo hit. It can force them to go and dig for more copies of the same program. It can lock them out of other servers that where you've got ice of the type that the program you've just destroyed will break. So if you kill their barrier breaker and you've got a really good barrier on a remote server, maybe they can't get through that, and maybe you can score an agenda through there, create scoring windows. So destroyers are really good. Taggers, ice that will give them tags or do damage to them, will help you to develop your offensive game plans if that's something you're doing. Then you've got end the run ice, which is probably the most important type. You want to be having end the run ice be at least the majority of the ice in your deck most of the time, because otherwise you're not actually forcing your opponent necessarily to get icebreakers, which is going to put you at an economic disadvantage over the game. And then you've got economy ice, or ice that gives the corp other benefits, such as allowing them to scry. Some of the Jinteki ice lets you look at the top cards of R&D and rearrange them. That's a benefit. But more commonly, played ice, such as Caduceus or Pop-Up Window, or even Shadow, will give the corp credits as well, which can be a benefit.
Speaking of credits, I think the other thing to consider is also having a good balance, not only of ice types, but also of ice costs, and particularly depending on which strategy you want to go for. So we often see that a lot of fast advanced lists will tend to go quite low in terms of ice costs in order to float enough credits to res their sand sands and to do their other things. Their money can be spent winning the game that way, whereas a more glacier style deck or in general just a slower deck will be wanting to generate more money, make the game go longer, and res tougher ice for the runner to get through. So it's also worth considering making sure you have a bit of a balance there, or that it is directly progressing your game plan.
Yeah, it's very important to have, whilst having a good spread of ice, it's also very important to have a good spread of strengths of your ice, seeing as breakers aren't the only way to go through ice. Runners that have more link will tend to have an easier time against tracers, such as Caduceus, that will require a trace to end the run, whereas normally your Anarchs might be carrying Parasite, or some of your Shaper decks carry Parasite as well, and so ice that carries a zero strength, even though it would be quite powerful, like Rototurrent, that costs 4 and it will die to a Parasite straight away. So if you have this spread of ice that includes things like Rototurrent and Quandary, or maybe Paperwall, or just any spread of zeros across the board, you'll find that you're going to be quite weak to Parasite, and Parasite will then be an easy way for your opponent to access your servers, or play one breaker and then play a Parasite in the same turn and get somewhere you previously thought they weren't able to. The same is true for Atman. If you have a very constant strength across your ice, one Atman can potentially get into all your servers, even though all your ice have different types, or even though your ice necessarily don't have types. An Atman at 4 will still go through a Mother Goddess, even though it doesn't have a subtype.
The other part of Mark's question was, are there certain types of ice that lend themselves to being placed in front of certain servers? I.e., is there a certain type of ice which is better to go in front of a remote protecting, say, a Sansan, or something that is better to go in front of R&D and locking them out of there?
Yeah, definitely. I think that if we can qualify ice in terms of not necessarily their efficiency, but in terms of what the likelihood of accessing from there is, we can often see exactly where we want to place our ice. This happens kind of independently of how the deck's built, but very dependently on how you draw your agendas in the game, or where your agendas are placed throughout the game. And I think that having control of where your agendas appear is very important. For example, if you're playing a deck with multiple Jackson Howards, you'll often have the ability to control where they end up, either be it in your hand, or be it in your archives, or be it in your deck. If you expect that over a long game, most of your agendas will end up in your deck, they're there so that your opponent is willing to score them from there, and so that you should place most of your efficient ice in front of your R&D. However, if you have an agenda that you want to score from your hand, well then you want to have multiple different kinds of ice on one server that you don't expect your opponent will be able to break through. And this is about finding scoring windows when it comes to playing ice, and this is about having good control of where your agendas appear.
One other thing that's worth considering is how easy it is for your opponent to get through and how often they're going to be running on that server. If you've got an economy ice or an ice that's giving you as the corp a benefit and it's not ending the run, you want to be having that on a central server or somewhere that you think the run is going to be running very frequently, so that you get the maximum benefit out of it and it provides that disadvantage to them running there every single time, because it's also not going to be doing a lot on a remote server where you're probably going to be trying to score out of. Not only are they not going to be running there very often, and is it not going to help you in scoring your agenda because it's not ending the run, but it's also going to cost you more to play that end the run ice because you're going to have to pay to play it further out.
I think as a general rule, you can normally expect the runner to want to access R&D the most. So if you are playing something like a Shadow, placing it on R&D is a good bet. You also normally want to have and end the run almost all the time on HQ, simply because account siphon is a big deal and you don't want to get hit by it very often. legwork is also a big deal.
Excellent. Now, moving into our second segment for the episode, we thought we'd do a bit of a deck building primer for the corporation. Basically, where to start when building a deck, what the necessities are, and how to prepare for the meta that you might be facing at the time. Jesse, how do you go about building a corp deck when you sit down with a new ID and a fresh pile of cards?
Generally, I'll be thinking about what the deck is trying to do, but I guess before you get to that even, you have your mandatory cards, so you have to include agendas. So you've got to, as part of that, how fast am I going to be playing? Am I going to be looking to score agendas from my hand? Am I playing a fast advanced strategy where you don't have to leave your agendas in play? If that's the sort of strategy you're playing, you don't want to be playing 5-for-3 agendas, for example. So the agenda portion of your deck should very much be tailored towards the type of deck you're playing. Because there aren't a lot of agendas at this point in the game in each faction, there's not many choices you can make in that space. The next part of the corp deck past agendas is operations, which is important. They are generally going to be your economy cards a lot of the time, or the cards that are going to advance your game plan. Operations are very much going to be tailored to what you're trying to do and to helping you get there. Ice is probably the most important part after agendas, actually, because without ice, you're going to lose the game straight away. So having ice is very important. They are defensive cards. They're the things that are going to protect your servers. I generally don't like to play less than 15 ice. You want to be seeing at least 2 ice in your opening hand most of the time. You want to be giving yourself a good chance at seeing 2 ice in your opening hand, and playing less than 15 is really asking for trouble, and it's asking for multiple mulligans.
And Jesse, what kind of things would a corp deck normally be trying to do? Can you give us some examples of some broad structural ideas that you might try to do with a corp deck?
Sure. When you look at each faction is going to have a few different strategies that the card pool is going to lend itself to at any particular time. So Haas Byroid's cards, particularly because Engineering the Future is the strongest identity, lends itself to a strategy of slow but steady building up of your defenses, playing some asset economy because Adonis campaign is very efficient, and then playing cards like Sansan City Grid or Ash into a remote server where you've built up some ice because you're able to install your ice more efficiently because you're getting that install credit every turn, and then using that server to score your agendas. So if you're playing that sort of strategy, what do you need? You need enough ice that you're going to be able to install one every turn, which means you're going to be looking at 16, 17, 18 ice. You need the cards to install in the servers like Sansan City Grid, Ash, or Adonis. And then you need operations and other things that are going to give you economy, perhaps blue level clearance, green level clearance, hedge funds. And then you need things that are going to allow you to score from hand as well, such as biotic labor. The utility cards that fit into your strategy, things like biotic labor, scorched earth, sea source, Mushin Noshin, for example, Neuralane P perhaps, those are often the cards that you'll put in last. But that's not to say that you shouldn't be building up to that strategy the whole way through. So your ice choices, your agenda choices should all be informing that.
What about when it comes to operations versus, say, assets and upgrades? Do you think that there's a certain percentage or a certain guideline that people should generally stick to avoid filling their deck with too many of one or the other?
I don't think there's a minimum number of operations. I think assets are, in general, one of the worst card types in the game at the moment, and that's mostly because of the power level that they're at the moment. Fantasy Flight Games hasn't really pushed the power level of a lot of cards early on. They were very cautious with that. And because of that, there really isn't a broad enough selection of assets that do a broad enough selection of things, have high enough trash cost, low enough install cost, low enough res cost rather, and actually do something relevant. So assets, I don't think you're going to be finding that there are many that are good, worth playing in your deck beyond perhaps Jackson Howard, Snare, Adonis Campaign. Those are really the only viable ones I can think of at this point. Upgrades, on the other hand, are very good. Upgrades can be used in servers with agendas, which makes them a lot more versatile in terms of gameplay. Assets and upgrades, because as I said, there's such a limited number and they do such a limited number of things, you're not necessarily looking for a ratio. You're just looking at which ones you need to play. So for instance, you need to play Sansan City Grid in a fast advanced deck. You want to play Ash in a Glacier deck or Corporate Troubleshooter, and then having lots of operations is good because it does give you that marginal advantage of not being trashable to anything but Imp. Yeah, in general, I think the operation card pool is much larger.
I definitely think that outside of the collection of assets that you really strictly do require for your style of game plan, operations normally the way to go. They tend to have a higher resilience to a whole host of runner strategies. So for example, assets required playing into servers, which might require icing up, And in turn, that requires you to play less ice on your central service. So it's often very difficult to have a consistent protective game plan on your central service while also protecting assets that you would want to play, assets like the root or assets like pad campaign. At the same time, assets are trashable for the corp. So, like Jesse was saying, cards like Imp or cards like Stim Hack or Bad Publicity, the mechanic, can often be very detrimental. Or you can feel the effects of them much worse if you do play a lot of assets, because that bad pub every run will be an extra credit, will reduce the overall cost for the runner to begin trashing your assets that you also had to install in servers, that you also had to maybe think about icing up, that you also had to lose protection on your centrals to protect over on the remote. People are going to run remotes less, and so that ice is also doing less. So you're losing efficiency on your ice whilst losing efficiency on your protective plan on your centrals, whilst losing efficiency in terms of just having natural resilience to things like legwork or to things like R&D interface. When you get multiple access and the runner can trash cards, they can do it again. And if they trash a shock, or if they trash a Melange mining company, or if they trash a snare on the way through, they took a bit of damage, that's fine. But then they get to run again and they see even more cards. So those turns where they can get in and they can run multiple times, all those cards just disappear. They're either agendas or they're assets, and all of a sudden they're just gone. Operations and ice protect your agendas and protect your assets no matter where they are, be it in your deck, your hand, or in play.
I like to always make sure that I focus on economy when I'm building a deck, any deck, right, whether it's corp or runner. If you ever have no credits, it always sucks to be kind of clicking for credits, like specifically just to get up to a certain amount. Like it's fine if you're, you know, doing stuff and you click for the occasional credit, but I always like to make sure I have a really healthy economy. And in testing, always trying to keep track of, you know, does this deck need one or two more economy cards, or in fact, does it need more action? That's something that I personally like to focus on a fair bit.
You pretty much want to be playing one economy card a turn on average throughout the game, at least every turn or every couple of turns, otherwise you get too far behind. So yeah, that's a really important part of the deck for sure.
Moving into our deck tech for the episode, we're going to talk a bit about Jinteki Replicating Perfection. Liam, you played this all the way through to the finals of our Melbourne Regionals tournament. You've stopped playing it recently. What can you tell us a bit about the deck and how it plays and what your general strategy is when
Yeah,
piloting it?
definitely. Replicating Perfection as a deck style is a glacially controlled Jinteki deck that really wants to punish the runner over a long, long game. I had a lot of fun playing it, and actually at regionals, I was undefeated all day with this RP deck up until the finals. It was a really good day in terms of RP, but I think a lot of that particular day was about Shinobi. Shinobi is certainly one of the key cards that made RP possible. Having a runner run into it and then immediately die gives you a lot of wins, and also from the perspective of tournament meta theory as a whole, it also gave me a lot of round time to chill out. RP.
Did you find that with Shinobi, you were only ever resining it to kill somebody,
To kill somebody?
or would you res it to just really slow somebody down, destroy their economy?
Yeah, like a runner with a without a Sentry Breaker that can survive a Shinobi, you still want to hit them with it 99% of the time. Scoring an APD contract in a glacial slow Replicating Perfection deck is as easy with five as it is with four, simply because you're going to put it in the remote server, you're going to advance it twice, and they're not going to be able to touch it. You've got Nisei Mark II that you've hopefully scored something you've scored previously that'll end a run. You've got this great series of central servers with deep ice, things like Enigma, things like Himitsubako, things like Eli, things like Ichi or Heimdall, and then on the outside of each of these servers, you'll just have a big, damaging, impermissible piece of ice that somebody doesn't want to run into. Not about ending the run, because if they run into it and it just ends the run, they bounce off and then they go on to run the remotes. You want them to go there and feel the burn when they reach there. Nothing small like Yagura Shinobi. Shinobi just on the outside, just like that, it's perfect for it. Putting Heimdall 2.0. I know we like to talk about 1.0, but 2.0 has all this extra brain damage, so it's absolutely great. Yeah, actually, I had a lot of fun playing this deck, notably because I really like Melange Mining Corporation as a card, and I really like Sundew as a card. So being able to play both of these in the deck, where I just get to play them into a remote, turn them face up, and have my opponent squirm a little bit, try and find a way to deal with it, make some mistakes while they try and deal with it, and then, you know.
You mentioned a moment ago when we were talking about corp deck building that you found that a lot of assets could be a problem and you were sometimes dead to the Maker's Eye or legwork. Did you find
Yeah.
that the trade-off for the power of something like Sundew, especially in a deck like Replicating Perfection, where you can leave it in a remote server uniced for quite a long time, was it worth it?
Yes and no. RP is a very unique Corp, I think, because your remote servers are fundamentally different from other corporations' remote servers. In the fact that the ICE on your centrals also protects the ICE on your remotes, provided that they're good enough on the outside. So part of running RP was that you are required to ICE up archives, because otherwise they can just run there and then they can just go straight to the remotes. I was playing about 19 ICE, I think, because what you ended up wanting to do was have a deep ICE on each server and then threatening ICE at the front, which means that you weren't really vulnerable to things like noise. You're not normally quite soft to noise because you've got archives iced up, and you're not normally cold to something like Keyhole because, again, you have archives iced up. The same goes with Desperado security testing kind of deal. But at the same time, you are playing Sundu, you are playing Mental Health Clinic, you are playing Melange Mining Corporation, you're playing all these assets and upgrades that are very trashable. And so when you do get hit by a Maker's Eye, when you do get hit by a legwork on your hand, it just disappears. They see an agenda, or they see two assets and an agenda, and they pay 3 credits and they just disappear. So you also spent a lot of time drawing cards.
With Replicating Perfection, I guess specifically, there are a lot of lists out there that go pretty deep on the century count, talking, you know, 10, 11, 12 centuries. How do you feel about these style of decks? Do you think it's the wrong way to go, or is it just another way to go?
No, I definitely don't feel like it's the wrong way to go. As far as like the glacial long pace of the game is concerned, more often than not, if we can just make the presumption that the runner is going to have a stronger economy than us, looking towards the extreme late game, we do want them to have to break our ice with a Century Breaker, with a Mimic and a Data Sucker that we can purge at our will, or with a Femme Fatale that will require a lot of credits to run. And the reason I think RP gets well suited for having lots of centuries is because of exactly that. The game is going to go very long, and we want them to be punished for having soft breakers that are century breakers. And it's not like you play exclusively centuries. You're still going to play an Eli, you're still going to play Himitsubakos, you're still going to play Quandaries and Enigmas. You need some good salt and pepper in there, some barriers and code gates to have deep in the servers, because otherwise the runners will just be able to throw away their Yogg or throw away their Kuroda. They'll be able to take a hit from a Rotar and not have to worry too much about it.
Also, Liam, just briefly, how would you suggest playing against Replicating Perfection?
I think probably a big role is to not get greedy. I think over the course of the day, I won most of my games because my opponents got greedy or because they felt desperate. They felt like it was impossible to get anywhere between maybe a Tollbooth or a Heimdall here or there. It would become incredibly expensive to access maybe just one or two cards off R&D or access a few cards in hand. And they would make a mistake somewhere and get killed by Shinobi. Or they would make a mistake and leave me a window in which to score a Nisei Mark II, and then that one snowballs out. Then you score the next Nisei, and because it's turn 15 or whatever, of course you've got two of them. You know, you've had a Jackson online for a few turns, you've got had a Sundu in play forever. Attacking the economy and forcing the Corp to play on your turns to live in the mid-game is a big deal because the ice is expensive. So even though there's a good spread of ice costs in the early game when you can choose between the Quandary and the Himitsubaka, towards the mid-game when you're acquiring the RP deck to res the Kamainu or to res a few of their more mid-range pieces of ice, it can often get just a little bit out of reach in terms of their economy if you've trashed their Sundu. So another thing there is that if you can trash a few cards from their hand, a lot of the time their Celebrity Gift will turn off. There are lots of ways to buy a few turns here or there.
I was just wondering, Liam, a couple of little things. One is, how many people do you think misunderstand the ID's ability and think that you have to make a successful run?
Yeah, but that's good to clarify right now. Replicating Perfection doesn't require a successful run. It just requires that a run be made, which again is why it's important that you put threatening ice at the front. And incidentally, it's why it's important that the deck have access to something like a 10 malign.
Oh, yes. Can you talk for a moment about 10 malign and how that was for you?
10 malign is possibly the most fun you can have while playing that runner. I mean that in the most genuine sense. I'm smiling right now just thinking about it. I know Wilfie is losing his mind at this because we have a good snicker about it all the time. 10 malign is great fun. And this deck isn't very good. I'm going to say that right now. This deck isn't that good. Coming out of that regional season, people knew what Shinobi was, and the deck doesn't really do that much. The 10 malign was so much fun. I really implore everyone to go out and just find a list they like and enjoy playing RP.
Just quickly on that, Shielzy, how many times have you swapped a piece of ice and then swapped it back again?
Exactly zero. The line is sweet because what you do is you put like Eli or whatever at the front of the server, and then you swap it into the server with the the piece of ice that's threatening. But of course, if they're not running that much, all your ice is face down, so it doesn't really matter what the hell you do with it. You just move stuff around and then they don't know what's going on. So again, you just make it, force them to make a mistake. Then they hit a shinobi and they die. So
my other question was about sort of keying into what you're talking about earlier, about how to play against it. One thing I found playing against replicating perfection is really important is not to give them scoring windows, and the way you do that is you don't run and you build up economy so that you can get into any server when you need to, because they need to install their agendas into remote servers because they're not playing a fast advanced strategy. So how, as the replicating perfection player, how did you find that need to play out your agendas and score them? Did you find that difficult against opponents who did sort of sit back a bit more?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely a detriment to Netrunner as the core game goes is that when you need to play an agenda into a remote server, the runner can simply change their style of play slightly so that you can no longer do that. If the runner can have enough money in their bank so that they can make a run or make two runs or make three runs in one turn and have them be successful, the windows for scoring that the co-op has access to get fundamentally smaller. And yeah, when runners do make mistakes, it's usually because they ran through a few servers too many times and paid too much, and they didn't score off the top, they didn't win right then and there, and then you get to have your mandatory draw and play something into a remote, pass, turn back, and then they look at your long remote, and they're on 3 credits and they need 12 or something like that. They can't access it anymore. But if the runner can sit around and stockpile 45 credits against replicating perfection, then they're going to be fine. They can just look at a server, wait for you to play something into it. They can make the run on the central, jack out as soon as they need to, and then make the run on the remote. There are a lot of ways RP can deal with this slight shift in the runner's playstyle. One way is to play Ash. The Ash will give you access to having 2 Ashes or 3 Ashes in the one upgradable remote server that you intend to score out of. You can res them one by one or res them both at the same time. It doesn't really matter because they're going to have to deal with these ashes one by one, as they can only access one. You're going to have a lot of money. You have sundews, you have mental health clinics, you have melange. So you are going to have a lot of money, and you need to use these ashes to leverage that financial burden onto the runner. The other way you can find these scoring windows again is to actually forfeit agendas. You can play an NAPD into a server, threaten to score it, threaten to score the game with that, and have them run there. They'll score the NAPD, it'll cost them a bunch, but then you can just play the next agenda in. The thing is, if they can run into 2 servers in one turn, that's very different from being able to run into 2 servers for the next 3 turns. And the runner still needs 7 points to win as well. So a lot of my games that day were won by playing agendas into these servers one by one, demanding that the runners go there to try and stop me winning, and then eventually they just ran out of cash.
Excellent. And if you'd like to try out Liam's list and wield the great power of the Tenma line, you can do that in the show notes just below. That's about all we have time for this week. As always, we'd love for you to get in touch. You can email us at thewinningagenda@gmail.com. Check us out on Facebook. Our like page is The Winning Agenda. And until then, we'll see you next week. Thank you very much. Bye, guys.
Thanks.
Cheers.